Welcome back. Your favorite tasty show here as we venture behind the kitchen doors. We don't want to know what's going on front. We want to know what's happening behind the kitchen doors. As we all love to go out to eat, but we never think about what goes into that effort to get the food in front of us here. The man who's been facing that battle, fighting that fight for many years here, Chef Pascal. Welcome, sir.
Hey, thank you, Paul.
Is it a battle to get the food out every day, or is it just a joyous thing, like little birds come and it's just happy things?
Well, you know, it's an enjoyment because we love cooking, but also we love challenge. We are crazy. Chefs are crazy. Loving challenge. Every day should not be a challenge, but we challenge ourselves.
Right, exactly.
And just to deliver thing that we love to do with passion. And talking about passion today, we have a guest who have a lot of passion and is also committed to do things that not many other chefs have achieved. He has a different philosophy that 98% of other chefs. So we're going to talk about his philosophy of cooking, his philosophy of eating, and he's way beyond just being in the kitchen. You know, he spent probably 50% of his time as a farmer. Actually, he called himself chef and farmer.
I saw that. He says chef and farmer. You can't be both. You can't grow it and serve it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the best way, you know. You know, you know how things grow. You know what you serve, and you can control it. It's very important.
Well, let's introduce him. You've teased him up here. Yeah. Who is this gentleman? Who is this magic magician here?
Chef Adam Navidi.
Hello, hello, everyone.
And the restaurant is?
Oceans and Earth.
And which is where?
Well, we have one in Yorba Linda right now, and we are building a second one over by South Coast Plaza in the Mets.
It's called the Met. It's a new development.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
So
super
what is
exciting.
The concept? I know you guys always hate to be defined. Tell me if I've never been there, what's the restaurant?
So our restaurant is, I mean, it's farm to table, but more than that, I mean, we're kind of, you know, we try to keep things unique and do some different things. And, of course, it's, you know, it all circles around what we're either growing. But we also do, like, dedicated gluten-free, too. So, you know, we make all of our, you know, every restaurant says they make everything in-house, but we really have to make everything in-house.
Are you really 100%
gluten-free? 100% gluten-free, yeah. There's not a, because, you know, we get celiacs and a lot of people that come into our restaurants.
So if somebody comes, say, can you just bring me some oil and butter and then I'll order my dinner?
Yeah, we can take care of that. We can do it. We can give them, you know, it's they're amazed. People are still amazed, you know, and I'm amazed because you would think more restaurants would do it. You know, we try to be allergy friendly across the board. Yeah, so we don't use nuts either in the restaurant. We don't have any nuts. So we, you know, we keep our dairy separate. We keep our seafood separate.
So do you
separate.
Make a gluten-free bread or something?
Yeah, so we make a gluten-free brioche. We make a gluten-free flatbread. We make a gluten-free baguette. We make gluten-free focaccia, cornbread, tortillas.
Why don't more do that, and how hard is it to do that?
Well, it's hard in the fact that you got to make everything, you know, so it's a little bit more labor-intensive. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know why more restaurants don't do it. I mean, they say like 1 in 3 has a gluten sensitivity, right? So, you know, it might be that they, you know, they get upset stomach or, you know, different things.
My wife has a severe dairy allergy, and she actually gets cysts and stuff if she eats butter or any cream or anything from a cow.
Yeah.
And we go to restaurants all the time. They say, oh, don't worry about it. But they're cross-contaminated. They're mixing stuff and everything here, and she's always so careful about it.
And do you have also some vegan dish?
Yeah, so we have vegan dishes, too, because we're farm-to-table. You got to have. Yeah. And, I mean, we get a lot of vegans that come in there. You know, not as much as we do, you know, the others. But, you know, for us, it's like we want, you know, it seems like every family has one person in their family now that you know, is either vegan or has a dairy allergy or a gluten. So we want the whole family to be able to come here and be able to eat and not have to worry about it.
Talking about that, we're going to go back to the food on some of your special tea ingredients. But you wanted to make your place like a cheers, like for the local to come and come back and to know each other from one table to another. And
everyone knows your name. Everyone's glad you came.
Yeah.
And
cheers.
So they know you, but also your wife is a big, very instrumental on that. She's really good in the dining room.
Yes. Yeah, she is. Yeah, I mean, she's my better half, really.
Yeah, yeah.
She, you know, she does all the stuff I don't want to do, you know. And so, yeah, I'm blessed. I'm blessed to have her with me. And, you know, we're actually, we're getting married this year, you know, and in
Are
November.
Are you not married?
Yeah, we're not married yet. We've been together 23 years. So
good
we
for you.
We had met at one of my, when we had one of my other restaurants in the Hyatt, Huntington Beach, we met there.
Wow.
And she was, you know, they had this big pep rally, and she was up there with the megaphone telling everybody where to go. And she looked over and kind of smiled at me, and I said, God, give me a good woman like that, and don't let me
so
be.
So that was your call.
Yeah, and I said, don't let me be stupid enough to lose her. And he's held his part up, so I got to do my part now.
Very,
you know?
Very good.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. Congratulations.
Yep. Yeah.
And are you going to cook for your own wedding?
We're not allowed to where we're getting married at, and they don't really want me to for that one. But I'm going to cook for the, you know, the night before.
Okay.
Yeah, for the rehearsal and all that.
So let's go back to more of the food you are dedicated to do. You got some awards, nationwide awards, but more biological or what was the award a few years ago? You say one of the five. Only a restaurant in the country.
Yeah, so well, we won the you know best gluten free restaurant in the nation by the Celiac Foundation. You know, we've won all kinds of different awards, but you know, we won Chef of the Year by the Orange County Food Writers Association, which that used to be a great big organization. Mm-hmm. It's you know since then it's starting to know
not many food writers left, not many places to write the stories. Yeah,
yeah, which is too bad because I love writing and I think that's. That's really what was exciting back in the day for people to read about restaurants and then want to go to them, you know.
But so you've been involved with a lot of charities as well.
Yeah, we've been involved in a lot of charities. But, I mean, going back to the awards, we've won, like, we were, like, one of the top 50 independent restaurants in the country. You know, so yeah, we've done that, but you know, more than awards is like you said, being that Cheers, being that local community restaurant where people come, and people come from afar even too. I mean, you know, we get people from all over the world, you know, and there's a lot of guests that come in and they'll say, you know, hey, we've been planning to come here for like 2 years, 3 years. We've been saving up to come, and we're gonna go to Disneyland, but we're gonna be here every night. We go to Disneyland, and we're going to come for
it's
dinner.
It's very close by. Actually.
Yeah, and I'm like, great. You know, it's awesome. And then you talk to people from, like, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, all these big food towns, and they go, there's nothing like this in New York or Chicago or San Francisco. Yeah. And you're going, wow, like, that's...
I have to say, a lot of people think Yerba Linda is out of the way. It's not. It's pretty easy to get there. I don't know, from the freeway
But I
system.
Don't think of it as a food town. I don't think of it as a food... It's not... It's not the beach town.
That's why
he has
a niche.
Yeah. Well, no, yeah, it is. All of my friends that are chefs go, what are you doing up in Applebee country up there? You know? Because, Yerba Linda is where the chain restaurants are. Chili's, right? Chili's started there. You got Mimi's Cafe started there. Yeah. A lot of, you know, and so, yeah, I mean, it's up in the hills. You know, you got the 91 freeway. You got traffic during the daytime. It's not the easiest place to get to. So that's why I think the new South Coast spot will really be attractive because we'll get a lot of people that
is a South Coast spot. It's going to be similar cuisine.
Yeah, similar cuisine. You know, we're going to be open for lunch. You know, it's funny because you always want to elevate it a little bit. You know, for me, I want to do, you know, new things all the time, of course. But, you know, you get your guests that say, oh, you got to keep this, or you got to keep this, or you got to, you know, they're already saying, you got to do your flatbreads, you got to do that. You know, there's a lot of things on my contract I already got to do. So, but, you know, we want to make it to where it's, you know, ultimately what it's about is about giving people something they can't
get
anywhere else.
It's a beautiful location.
Yeah.
A beautiful landscape there.
Yeah.
And, you know, close to the businesses, close to South Coast Plaza, you know, and right there on the freeway. So, yeah.
And you got the three big Met buildings there, and we're right off Anton and Flower there. And you got the hotels, you got the Seagram Center there. A lot of potential. And we got a big space to do events there, too. There's already companies saying, hey, we want to start having our events there.
There you go.
You know? So and we get a bunch of chefs together and we cook and have fun. And we love doing that, right?
Wonderful. So you're very specific about what you serve, but also you're very specific what you grow on the raise. I say raise because you don't just grow vegetables and produce. You raise livestock like a fish.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so our farm, Future Foods Farms, we had that for 12 years. We had to close the big one down a couple years back because they're going to build homes out there. It was us, the strawberry farm, the Christmas tree lot.
Where is this at?
This was out in Brea. It was about 4 miles away from our restaurant.
Okay.
So we had that for 12 years, and it was the largest aquaponic farm in the state of California. We had, you know, over 40.
Can you explain aquaponics?
Yeah, aquaponics is aquaculture and hydroponic, the two sciences put together. So it's kind of the only way to really do hydroponics organically, and that's by having fish, having tilapia that produce the ammonia, the nutrients that the plants need to grow, and that plants in return filter, clean the water, and the water returns to the fish tank. So it's a little...
Full circle.
Yeah, full circle, sustainable ecosystem. Mm-hmm. You know,
and what would you grow there? You'd grow fish and vegetables?
Yeah, or? So we had about 30,000 tilapia there. Wow. And then we'd grow about 500 pounds.
We're not talking about a little tilapia. Some of them.
Yeah. You know who came out? You know, Jacques Cousteau's grandson, Philippe Cousteau, came out and he shot a documentary about our farm called Exploration Awesome Planet. It's on Hulu TV. You can find it.
I love it.
And he won an Emmy Award for daytime television for educational shows.
Wonderful.
But that was cool because he was impressed. He's like, you know, I gave him a net to catch some fish out of our big, and he pulls out like a 5-pound tilapia, and he's going, wow, this is like one of the biggest tilapia I've ever seen
in
my life.
That's a catch of the day.
Yeah.
So you grew fish, and it was just for you, or it must have been for other places?
Yeah, well, we started growing just for me mostly. That's really why I got into this thing. I started this in my backyard back in, 2000. We started the farm in like 2008. And then we started doing dinners on our farm as well, too, every Saturday night. So that kind of started this trend of doing dinners on farms in Orange County and Southern California.
You like to do that. You're very involved on the farm chef dinners.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, for us, it was like, you know, we were trying to do this thing. When we had a restaurant on the High Huntington Beach, when we left that, you know, we found a spot in Huntington Beach where we wanted to have a biosphere behind the restaurant. And at that time...
A biosphere. You say that so quickly. What's a biosphere?
A biosphere where we'd be
a contained bubble where you grew like...
Like a greenhouse. Yeah. And then we wanted to be able to grow our fish and our produce in there because I was already doing it in my backyard. So I'm like, let's do this. Let's do this behind a restaurant and people will come and want to see it. And at that time, the zoning laws were, you can't do agriculture in a commercial zone.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, if I can't do agriculture in a commercial zone, I'll do commercial
even for
in
your
an
own,
agriculture
even
zone.
Even for your own use?
Even for your own use. For some reason, that was in Huntington Beach, they were saying, even for the restaurant. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't my own use, but it was for the restaurant.
In your backyard or something? They don't want you raising goats in your backyard.
Well, behind the restaurant, right?
Yeah,
that's
right.
The whole thing, is you can't do agriculture.
You don't think
commercial.
Anybody could grow weeds in
weeds, maybe.
So I said, well, if I can't do that, then I'll do agriculture in a commercial zone. So I found, I'll do commercial and agriculture. So I go, if In-N-Out Burger can park a trailer out in the middle of the desert and serve cheeseburgers out of it, why can't I do dinners on my own farm?
Yeah, sure.
And so I bought an old beat-up nursery and turned it into an aquaponic farm. And it was fun, man. I mean, we did it every Saturday night. It was 40 seats in the middle of a greenhouse. You'd have, you know, all these things growing alongside
you. At the same time that you opened the restaurant?
No, I had that before my restaurant. I had that from about 2008, right in between middle of 2008 and 2009, all the way till 2021, just about after COVID, when COVID was ending.
Okay.
And so,
why have I never heard of this? What a cool idea. I'm sorry, I'm the last one to know here.
Well, and it was fun, too, because you get everybody from all over would come, you know, and they'd park at this elementary school, and we'd pick them up in the van, and we'd bring them on to the property. And at first, everybody would be looking at their cell phones, like, do we get recovery? Where are we going? Like, coverage? You know, like, and then they walk into greenhouse one, and here's a big magnum of vouv, you know, and champagne glasses, and they can see the whole, you know, table set out. So we'd give them a glass of champagne, and then we'd walk into three or four of the other greenhouses, because we had 10 greenhouses, and we'd show them each different system, how we were growing things. Meanwhile, my staff would be in the kitchen, in our makeshift farm kitchen, you know.
You're sure there was no champagne in the kitchen?
Yeah, there was champagne in the kitchen, too. But they would be stoking the little fire, and we built a little oven kind of thing. It was like cooking on a campfire.
Mm-hmm. This seems to be a trend, still a small trend, but a trend of urban farming, of trying to bring farming back into urban areas. Right now, farms are way out somewhere, and then the food has to be transported in because the land is cheaper out there, and it's too expensive to grow here. But we've had people come in different ways, shapes, either vertical farming or what you're talking about.
There's a few pesos.
Hydroponic stuff, trying to grow in an urban commercial area.
In Orange County, you have the ecology center.
College,
you have the strawberry farm and do that also.
So these guys all came out to our farm and said, hey, they saw our dinners and came to our dinners. And they said, why don't we start doing dinners on our farms?
Absolutely.
And that started in the strawberries, the Tanakas, the eco, all these guys started getting into that. To that thing, but we still are the only ones that we're doing inside of a greenhouse, which is cool, you know.
I would think,
because it's all lit up, and you're like, you feel the moisture of being in there.
Yeah.
And it's cool. I mean, I remember one of our first press things we did was in August, and it was, you know, like 105 degrees outside, and we're in a greenhouse, and I'm just like, I'm dumping ice into the cooling walls to try and keep it, because we've got all these ladies, they're all dressed up, and you know, we want them to be nice and cool
and
in there.
So you also. Invite students, or you were involved with Orange Coast College, correct?
Yeah. So we're involved now with Orange Coast College. They have a couple greenhouses there. Mm-hmm. They started out. We became friends years ago. They had come out to our farm and seen it, and so they wanted to put aquaponics in. So you know, we gave them some fish and some things to get them started, and they've been doing an awesome job with it.
That is great.
Yeah. They've really built it up nicely, and the students are really into it.
So you're mentoring that philosophy.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, this is really for me, it's got to happen for the future of life. You know, I mean, we have to find ways of being more sustainable and growing our own food.
Do you call your philosophy being ecologic?
Ecology?
Ecology system?
Yeah. I mean, I would say so. You know, we always say it's like sustaining the plant one plate at a time, or building a better future. It's almost kind of goes back to biblical, right? It's like, you know, you give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. You teach a man to fish, you feed him for life. If you teach him how, and then I added on to that, if you teach a man how to grow fish, you know, how to be a fish farmer, then you feed his community for life, you know, because we need more fish farmers. We got it, you know. We know what's going on with the oceans.
Is this feed at all into what you're doing, Pascal, with your friend and the salmon?
That's
and all
what we are working on, to have a really sustainable ocean fish farming,
right?
Yep.
And because an ocean fish wasn't really controlled before, but now we can.
Well, and they're overfishing, and then they're all the collateral damage,
overfed,
whatever. They pull stuff in a net, they get a whole bunch of it, kill a whole bunch of other fish.
And they give them medication.
And a lot of our fish were coming from other countries. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, America, I mean, I think we produced like maybe 10 or 15% of the fish that everyone's buying in the stores. Most of it, 80% of it's coming from China and stuff. So, and to be able to have better control of where our stuff's coming from, to know what's in there, to know we're getting exactly what we're buying.
Is there a place where we can get your tilapia?
Well, right now, no, there's not. We, you know, we when we had the big farm, we had the big fish going. You had asked before if we were growing. You know, we started selling at 15 farmers markets a week.
Right.
We started selling to other restaurants. And so, you know, when we closed that, because we were doing about 30,000 heads of lettuce a month.
Wow.
You know, which is way more than I could do. And that was me and one guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I only had one guy working on the farm. You know, but I mean, he was a good guy. I mean,
he was working.
he was a heavy worker, and he'd been working on that nursery for like 15 or 20 years before I bought it.
So that's not, you shut that down? You don't have that anymore?
Yeah, so we had to shut that down. They're going to build homes out there. They need more homes, right? It's like, you know, I drive by and I see the sign. It says, you know, building better communities or bigger communities. And I'm thinking the sign should say building a sustainable community, right? You know what I mean? Like there should be.
We're not worried about
that. Possible?
Well, I look and I go, because I'm kind of, you know, my father was an engineer, and I'm always thinking about how do I engineer, think of things up, and I'm always thinking, you know, someday somebody's going to build a community where it's got an aquaponic system, and you know, your pools in your backyard are all fresh water that are flowing in, and you know, all your sprinklers
what
and all your water, all your water's going to run into that.
You can have a reservoir, underground reservoir. You can recycle for your own backyard or front yard.
Yeah, but the whole community, you know, just have it all flow down to one area in the bottom, and like you said, have a reservoir
more
there.
More than just a little communal farm or a little communal garden where they have you can play and plant a few things here.
Yeah.
You're talking about really something that could sustain
the
community.
No, we need to come up, especially with your like coming up with El Nino, we're going to have some big storms. You got to save that water somewhere.
Yeah.
It's not just to keep your grass
green. Just run it off into the ocean?
No, it goes down, you don't know where.
Yeah.
So, there is no groundwater in half of the county.
Yeah.
Did you know that? We've done lots of shows on water here. The northern half has groundwater, but the southern half has no groundwater in it. So they're trying to find out ways to maximize, get more out of it. We've had all the water districts in, and it's a constant problem. How do you
capture water and save it? They have a system of a reservoir, underground reservoir. And then they pump out for sprinklers or whatever.
Yeah.
You talk about your dad earlier. Is your mother was a big influence into cooking for you?
Yeah. My mother and my father were both big influences in my cooking. My mother was, you know, the type that it was like, you know, I was kind of a crazy kid, you know, growing up, and so
you're still crazy.
I didn't do well in schools, you know, and so
where did you grow up?
Whenever they said you got to go home, I go home, and my mom would be like, "All right, what are you going to cook for dinner tonight? You know, you're not going to go outside and skateboard and play around. You know, if you're not going to school, you're gonna learn how to cook."
And where was this at?
I grew up in Yorba Linda.
Oh, okay. Now it explains. I was going to say, why Yorba Linda? Yeah.
So going back to that story with Pascal, too, a little bit, is that, you know, my mother would say, okay, you know, you're going to cook something, so I'd make dinner. And, you know, every night she would entertain people. You know, we'd have neighborhood friends there. Mm-hmm. So there'd be like 10 or 12 people sitting at the table. So I kind of really learned that from her. With my father, him being an engineer, but he'd also have a little farm out in the backyard. Hmm. And so every night, you know, he'd go out there and he'd pick whatever he had and he'd make a salad with fresh vegetables. And, you know, it was, for us as kids growing up, it was like, you know, we didn't want to eat all those vegetables all the time, you know. My mom would order a big pizza or something when she wasn't cooking dinner. And I'd sit there and I'd watch my father not eat a slice of pizza. He'd sit there and eat a salad. And I'd think, wow, it's weird. He doesn't like pizza, you know. But now that I've gotten older, I realize that you can't eat pizza all the time, you know. And eating those vegetables are really what make you feel good. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's, you know, it's about listening to your body and what makes you feel good. But my mother and my father came up to a restaurant when I was working in Bend, Oregon, and, you know, I didn't, it was a nice...
I see you work in Oregon.
Yeah, I worked in Bend, Oregon, at a place called Broken Top, and it was kind of my first, like, stepping into a real fine dining restaurant, you know. It was a four-diamond restaurant. It was the head chef from the Hotel Bel Air and the mansion on Turtle Creek. Wow. So at that time, you had Dean Faring at the mansion of Turtle Creek. He was considered to be one of the greatest restaurants in the country at that time. So it was one of his sous chefs that had come there, and he had also worked at Hotel Bel Air, and they had the GM there. And so they were like, okay, you know, we're going to do this, you know, great food. And so I got a chance to learn, and I got a chance, too, where they had every year they'd do the food and wine.
Yeah.
Top six chefs in the country would come there, and they'd cook whatever made them famous. So I got to meet all these great chefs, you know. So I was there 3 or 4 years, and every year I worked with one year I worked with John George with Grinton, one year I worked with Dean Faring, Jody Denton out of San Francisco. So I got a chance to see, you know, I go, man, this is pretty cool. I wouldn't mind doing this maybe for a living, you know. At that time I was still a pro snowboarder, so I thought I was going to be,
snowboarder.
Yeah, I was a pro snowboarder.
Talking about that.
Yeah.
Describe how on why you call your restaurant Ocean on Earth.
Okay, so I call my restaurant Oceans on Earth because, you know, one, I like surfing tourists, but also because of my love for the ocean. So I'm a surfer, and also my love for the mountains and the snow. So I'm a snowboarder. And, you know, years ago, 30 years ago, you know, you'd start hearing things, you know, about how, the ocean's going to rise, you know, a foot or two, and we're going to lose some of our best surf breaks because those are all in reef spots, and how the snow's going to stop dropping below 6,000 feet, where, you know, half of our ski resorts are below 6,000 feet. So I was concerned then, you know, about, you know, kind of this global warming or whatever they were using that wording as back then. So that's why I just thought to call it Oceans on Earth. So my mom and my dad came up to my restaurant in Bend, Oregon, and I made them this nice fancy dinner, and I was doing creme brulee tableside, and my mom's, you know, so super excited that her son, who was a bit crazy growing up, is now turning into this, you know, responsible chef, kind of found a way to, you know, or not even a chef at that point, I was a cook. And so she goes, Adam, you got to open a restaurant one day. What are you going to call it? I said, I'll call it Oceans on Earth. And she says, that's a beautiful name. She goes, you got to promise me you open it in our hometown in Yorba Linda because we need a really good restaurant in Yorba Linda. And so I made that promise, and I kept it. 20 years later, we opened Oceans on Earth in Yorba Linda in a location that I had been trying to buy several times before, but it never, I got outbid or something happened with the...
And how did that play in upper suburbia like that? I mean, Yorba Linda is the land of Applebee's and Mimi's. It's a very nice upscale neighborhood, but they like chain food generally. Yeah.
Well, so, actually, it's between ocean and earth. Between the mountain and the ocean.
There you go.
So was it, Chef Pascal talked about this, coming down and opening a fancy fresh restaurant here in the 80s when there wasn't anything like that.
Yeah.
This is sleepy suburbia. Did people respond to it? Did they take a while to warm up to
it? When you have so much personality and you bring a specific product, there's a wow factor.
There is a wow factor.
Right. It's a wow factor, and then you find something that anybody in your family or in your friends around is going to like, and you come back for it, you know, because it's not only just cooking gluten-free, it's cooking with a lot of taste, a lot of flavor.
So how did it react? Were people ready for it? Did it take a while to educate them?
Well, it took a little. In the beginning, you know, the first year or 2 years, you know, we were taking over an old spot that kind of had been changing restaurants every year or 2 years. You know, they called it the cursed corner, right? So it's like, of course you got to hear all these.
It's actually a beautiful location.
It's a beautiful location.
And there are locations like that. You see restaurants just turn. It seems like it's a hot spot and yet nothing can take. Yeah. One concept after another goes until finally somebody figures it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, it's funny because it's like I've had a couple restaurants that were like that. You know, I mean, my other restaurant before that, I was Green to Go in Brea, and it was a restaurant that used to be a Starbucks, and Starbucks failed there. They couldn't pay it. Mm-hmm. So they ended up like having to pay a percentage of the rent for a little while, and so we had moved in there, and we made that thing, you know, take off, and then we opened up this restaurant, Oceans and Earth, and before that, I had catering companies that I worked with that weren't, you know, that weren't doing that well when we first started out, and so you kind of build these things up, but the only way you do it is by being there, and by, like Chef says, to have a love, and to listen to people, you know, you listen to your customers and what they want. You know, we started out in Yorba Linda with like a tasting menu prefix, and that wasn't going to work in that area, you know. And a lot of my neighbors and a lot of my close friends were like, Adam, we love you and we love your food, but, you know, we're not going to go out every night, every week for, you know, for an upscale dinner. But you put tacos or burgers on there and we'll come every week, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so you end up putting, you know, you want to, you know, take care of the customers that are in your local area right there and your friends and everybody. So, you know, we end up putting tacos and burger on there. And so, you know, it's like, you know, we listen to people and we've evolved. But it's funny because a lot of our menu items are still very similar menu items than when we first opened, and people are like, "Wow, the menu looks like it's changed a lot over the years," and it, you know, it really hasn't. You know, it's just we've added a couple of little.
So, what are specialties? What would you recommend people?
I was going to ask, what would be a specific dish that you do on nobody can find it anywhere else, and why it's different?
Okay. Yeah, so the other part of Oceans and Earth is that, you know, surf and turf, right? So it's like, you know, I like that, too, as well. I've always, you know, because I come from...
It's like chef and farmer.
Chef and farmer. Because I come from chef and farmer, I mean,
I don't know any chef and farmers. Okay.
You know, I'm not a guy that just goes out and eats a steak. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm not a guy that just goes out and order... I mean, I like little bites. That's why I like prefix menus and things like that, because, I after you eat three or four bites, right, it becomes, you know...
Give me the next one.
Yeah, give me something different. So, you know, for us, it's like being able to do something that's like a tasting of tides, right? A tasting of the ocean.
Yeah, sharing plates.
So. Yeah, sharing plates or a tasting of earth, you know what I mean? And like do things that, you know, maybe people haven't seen before, you know what I mean? So we're working on a dish right now that's called foraging, right, for truffles.
Foraging,
right?
Okay.
And so, you know, we got this thing that looks like a tree log that we're putting fake dirt in.
Do you have a pig and we have to go out in the back or something?
Yeah, so we have a shovel there. But more funnier than that is we got the fake pig noses, right, with the rubber band. So, the customer puts on the pig nose with the rubber band, and then we got a little shovel for them to dig and forge for their own. And we're doing like an arancini, you know, like a risotto ball with black truffle and black crust on it and you know, homemade cheese, with truffle cheese in the middle, you know. So they got to dig for their own.
They got to dig for their food. Right?
You know, so you're kind of making it an interactive thing now, right? You're doing something where the guest, you know, is now interactive into their food and into being, you know, filling. What does it feel like to actually kind of go foraging for?
So they have to dig for their food.
They have to dig for their food. Most people don't want to put the pig nose on, but it's funny when you tell them to do it.
So is that part of this whole idea of experiential is the new thing? If I'm going to go out and do anything, if I'm going to go to a retail store, if I'm going to go to a restaurant, I want to experience something. I don't want to just buy something.
I think so, definitely. I think that's the big. And I mean, we all learn that kind of, you know, when you look at the Knott's Berry Farms and the Disneylands and all that stuff, it started off as kind of as a little restaurant or something, a little farm, and then it was
a restaurant can be an entertainment.
Yeah. Entertainment. Yeah. You got to experience something. Yeah. You don't just go out, whether it's the ambiance, whether it's the dish, whether it's the service, whether it's doing a table side, whatever, you're doing something you can't just take and go.
Is there any other dish? Do you still do the creme brulee table side?
Yeah, we don't do a table side anymore. We started in the very beginning with the cart and doing like different flavors and different sizes. But then, you know, it was the cart's a little bit loud, right? The wheels start to wear down, or, you know, it just starts making noise on the tile. And so now you kind of
burn yourself a couple of times.
Or the staff burn themselves too, right? You know, it's like trying to teach staff how to do something like that is a little scary sometimes.
Can I ask you two a question? Because now you hit a hot button for me. I love good creme brulee. I rarely get good creme brulee. The creme is either like just custard and thick and gooey or too runny or whatever, and the little icing on the top, the little burnt sugar, is either too hard, too thick. Is it that tough? What is so tough about getting a great creme brulee? Or am I just too picky?
It's not that tough.
Yeah, it's not that tough. I mean, so the thing that's my signature kind of creme brulee, when you talk about a creme brulee, is, you know, we started a catering company right in 1998. So I've been catering, you know, all of Newport Coast, a bunch of places. And we actually have the same clients we're doing the events for this summer that we've been doing now 27 years now, you know, and they could have anybody. But so going back to our creme brulee, so we do ours, which kind of makes us our signature, is we do it in a caviar tin, right? So we bake the creme brulee inside there. We put sea lavender and vanilla bean in the custard, and then we do the caviar.
Sea lavender, okay.
Sea lavender and vanilla bean, and then we do the caviar on top. We make it look like salmon eggs, you know, sitting in a tin of caviar with the caviar lid on it. And, you know, at first people are like, "Wow, what is that? We didn't order caviar, you know." And we did that because, you know, as a kid growing up, it was like salmon eggs were the grossest thing to me when I was a kid. You'd be fishing with them and stuff, and you'd be like, "Who would ever eat these things?" Right?
Exactly.
You know, so we want to. It's again a guest experience, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so we serve this passion fruit caviar on top of our creme brulee. Now, you know, we get that nice crust on there, but when you put those salmon eggs on that half of that portion, it does soften up that top portion of the creme brulee, and then you get the crunchy part on the other side. But it's just, again, serving something kind of in a way that people haven't seen before. You know,
but you do a regular creme brulee.
That's our creme brulee right
now. That's his regular.
That's our regular creme brulee. Yeah, on the menu right now.
Sweet and savory.
Sweet and savory. So yeah, well, it's more sweet than it is savory.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the lavender adds a little bit of, you know, floralness to it, right? But the passion fruit.
I'm going to have to try this because I love creme brulee, and I'm always disappointed everywhere I go.
Yeah, I mean, these little pearls look just like salmon eggs, too. You know, they're passion fruit. Yeah. So you put those in your mouth, they pop.
They pop. Yeah.
So it's kind of a fun, you know, a fun take on the, you know, you got your traditional French, right? I mean, I grew up, too, with, you know, when I worked at restaurants. So, you know, we never really started off with where, when I was 15 years old, I worked at Chili's, right? You know, and then I moved to Vail, Colorado.
Because you're a snowboarder.
Because I'm a snowboarder, you know. So I was 17 years old. 17 years old, jumped on a Greyhound bus, went to Colorado, got a job in a day, working in a little Mexican restaurant right on the ski resort there. Worked there for a little while, then French restaurant down the street. Got a job working at a French restaurant where I learned a lot of different techniques. You know, it was a small family-run thing. And then from there, I went to, I worked at a bar for a little while, you know, as a chef. You know, they kind of hired me because back then, you know, I was cooking burgers and cooking. But you kind of learn, you know, then, like, what does it be to be they didn't call you a chef. It was a kitchen manager, right?
Yeah.
So worked there for a while. Then we went to Oregon after, you know, being in Vail, Colorado for a couple of years. I went to Oregon, Mount Bachelor, and Bend, Oregon. And
when did you decide snowboarding is not my future?
So I was working at that resort, Broken Top, in Bend, Oregon, and they came out to do a photo shoot for me for a magazine.
Because you're a pro snowboarder.
And an hour before the guys show up with the cameras, my family, brothers are all there and stuff, you know, just taking an easy run down, I decided to launch off this hit. And I flew out sideways, landed on my arm, broke my wrist in three places, dislocated my elbow, broke my ribs.
For a photo shoot.
So I get down to the bottom, and I'm going, no, not today. Not of all days, you know. And so they couldn't take the pictures. We couldn't get the shoot. My sponsors dropped me. I walk back into the restaurant, and the chefs are like, that's all right. This is what you're supposed to be doing anyways.
Really?
You know,
wow.
they're like, you have a talent and a skill for this. And they're like, snowboarding has no longevity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can only snowboard for so long. But they're like, you really have a knack at this, kid. Like, you need to think about doing this professionally.
So you said you made a deal with God when he introduced you to this girl, and you were able to hold on to her. Was this another instance God was trying to tell you something the hard way here?
Yep, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's your
knocked you off the board to get you to wake up?
That's your last descent.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. What a story.
Yeah. So, you know, and then getting the chance to meet all these other chefs, and, you know, these guys are traveling around, having fun, going, you know, and I'm going, man, that's the life, right? These guys are making money and they're chefs. They got to go around, have fun, and travel around. I mean, I'm not traveling around that much like those guys were, but not yet. Maybe someday. But that's really what kind of stoked me into becoming a chef. And so then they said, boom, go to culinary school. So moved up to Seattle, went to culinary school, worked at, it was funny because I actually was working at one of the nicer restaurants up in Kirkland, Washington, right on the water's edge there. And they were like, yeah, so I'm going to culinary school, and I'm next in line to be kind of the kitchen manager. Mm-hmm. There they had chefs, you know. But So when I was at Broken Top, when I was in Bend, Oregon, you know, my chef there and all this stuff, they would say, you know, you can't call yourself a chef until... The old school thing was until the chefs that you've worked under mm-hmm. tell you you can call yourself a chef, mm. you know. So, you know, when I was younger, you could never use that word chef on yourself, you know.
Somebody had to bestow that on you.
Yeah, so even when I went to culinary school, after I got our culinary, I was like, you know, I'm still not really a chef, you know. And so I moved back down to Bend, Oregon, because I missed the snowboarding down there. And I invited the chef that I worked with from Broken Top, and I invited the other chefs that I had worked under. So I had three chefs there. I made them dinner one night, and I go, you know, like a six-course, seven-course dinner. I'd just gotten this job as the head kitchen manager at this little golf course called Widgie Creek, right? I was the youngest kitchen manager chef they had hired there by like 20 years. You know, the youngest one before was like 42 years old. And the girl hired me, I was 22 years old. You know, but the food and beverage girl, but she kind of had the hots for me. So that's why I think she hired me, you know. So I invited these chefs over, the chefs that I
worked
with.
Your wife's listening to this, or your soon-to-be wife's listening
to this. So the chefs that I'm working for, or I had worked under, I invite them in. So they come in for dinner. I make them this really nice dinner with a little bit of influence from each one of them. Mm-hmm. At the end of the dinner, I go, you know, can I call myself a chef? And they said, yeah, you can call yourself a chef.
Wow.
So I went, cool. So that's how I never used
it. It's like a knight. You know, you can't become a knight unless somebody knights you. Another knight has to.
Yeah.
Yeah. You
put the sword
down. Yes. Boom.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you don't see that nowadays. You know what I mean? You see a lot of kids coming out of school.
They call themselves chefs.
They call themselves chefs, you know?
Yeah.
So.
So.
What do you tell people when they say chefs and cook? Do you give them a definition of what a chef is?
Yeah, what do you say is a chef or a cook?
It's very hard these days because when you see shows on TV,
they all
call each other chef.
Yeah.
Even if they are line cook. Hey, chef.
Right.
And so it's not a title on its own now, except on your resume, you put if you are chef, kitchen, restaurant chef, or chef or kitchen manager, or you have executive chef or corporate chef.
Yeah, they have a distinction.
Yeah, no, there's more distinction.
You know?
And,
you call everybody chef.
Well,
you're pretty open with you. Hey,
more
chef.
Because more than my friend are chef.
But you've had people that come in that were just, a chef to me has to be at a restaurant, some other things, but if somebody is even preparing food as catering and other things like that, you'll say chef.
Well,
I wouldn't normally have thought of calling somebody who does catering a chef.
I do have some people that work for me. They're asking if they can be called chef.
They want the title.
And so I think, you know, that's fine because they want to have some independence, you know.
Right. They aspire to.
So they can run their own catering company and say, oh, I own my own catering company as a chef.
Yeah.
Right.
So they cannot
say... It's a title of distinction.
They cannot...
Yeah. That you're part of the club.
Get jobs. Say, oh, I'm a cook of my own catering company. No, I'm a chef.
Yeah.
Right.
So, and I've always thought it was, you know, the difference between a cook and a chef was, you know, a cook cooks somebody else's recipe, mm-hmm. right? You know,
mm-hmm.
where a chef creates his own recipes,
that
you know.
Sense.
Not by looking in a book or by creating it out of your head and going, you know, will this work and will this happen, you know? And then also the old school where they, you know.
Well, the old school, you call the order and say, you got to hear, yes, chef.
Yeah.
And it's very important. And then, when do you think your new place is going to open?
All right, so we're talking about the Oceans and Earth at the Met, South Coast Plaza. It's probably going to be, they're giving us a date of like March, somewhere in March. So, of course, you want to do some soft openings and things like that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm sure we'll keep everybody updated.
I hope we get invited to the
anybody to the grand
that we can
openings
get in
and stuff. Yeah. Chef knows how it is. It's like you don't want everybody coming the first night, right?
No.
I mean, when we opened our restaurant in Urbalina, that's kind of what it was like. It was like they sent out. You know, it was the fire chief comes in, and he does the last inspection, right? And he goes, all right, I'm signing off on you. So you're like, cool, now let's go to the store, get all the food. Because you're not allowed to have anything in the place, no food.
Right.
So you run out, you get everything you can, and you're like, all right, we're going to have some friends overnight or soft opening tonight, couple, you know. Because we're like 4 months behind at this point, you know. So we open up the place. So we open up the place, and it's like there's a line out the door. Someone had sent the whole city of Yorba Linda an email saying Oceans and Earth is opening tonight, and they're doing free appetizers.
Yeah, there you go.
And so everybody's coming for those. You know, so it's like, okay, hold on. We're going to turn this into like a buffet kind of thing because there's no way we're going to be able to feed. All these people.
And then the first impression is very important.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they wait forever to get food, they may think a little bit before they come back.
Yeah, so that's super important, your opening dates. You never really kind of want to have an exact date for everybody to know because you want them to wait a little bit.
But these days, when you do self-opening, you have to put that into your budget. Because, you know, it is a big budget, you know. You give away food and for maybe a week or something.
Ooh, yeah, hopefully not.
But also, you have some good people in your kitchen. I know some of them. I know your assistants.
Yeah. We've had a lot of guys. We've had guys that were working with me for like 16 years. We have one of the guys, back when I was 17, right, before I left and went to Colorado and stuff, I worked for a small catering company. And, you know, part of a guy that I met there that was helping in their kitchen is working in my kitchen, you know. And so, like, there's, you know, we have long relationships with a lot of the people that we've had. You know, every once in a while you lose, like I mentioned, we have a guy with me for 16 years, you know, it's, you know, you lose good people like that sometimes. You know, he met a girl. She wanted to move to Washington, get married, and they have family.
Girls. And you girls know, are the source of problems.
And that draws them away, you know, which is unfortunate. Yeah. But, you know that's what's going to happen, right? And especially in this industry, you know, that's why when I sit down and I interview somebody, I say, you know, for us, our job is to make you better cooks. You know, when you come in the restaurant to when you leave, we want you to go and represent us and be a, you know, show that you've learned. So when you go to another restaurant, they go, hey, they've worked at Oceans and Earth. They probably know kind of some stuff of what to do, you know.
And I go, you know, is the world getting different? I know Chef works at a culinary school. He teaches.
Oh, yeah. Before you get guys that would, you know, you would be happy just to get your foot in the door, right? To go in and work at a place, especially with a good chef, you know. And
you'd do anything. You'd be the dishwasher.
Yeah, you'd do anything you could to work your way up, and you'd stay for a couple of years because that's really the only way you learn. I mean, you can't learn a whole restaurant in 6 months or a year, you know. But you see, nowadays, you see, you know, more of a lot of the people are bouncing around. You know, I'm looking at resumes all the time where somebody is 4 months here, 4 months there, you know, and that's never a good sign for me to hire someone who bounces around a lot like that. And I understand why they think they want to do that. So they think they can learn a little bit of, like, they think they're quick learners or something. But, you know, for me, part of it is, like, you know, even just recipes well, too. Like, how are you gonna perfect a station in only 4 months, right?
Us as a chef, when you open a restaurant with a new menu, or if you change your menu seasonally, you know, it's not great the first day. You always adjust day after day, you know, first to make it easier, not easier, but more practical to produce in case, you know, you get swamped. And also, you can always make adjustments, you know. So I guess it's like acting, you know, you have the script and then you go, you make it even better, and then you're acting better after that.
Yeah.
So...
It's the little details, right?
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know, chef. It's like people know when Pascal's in the kitchen. You know, they know his food. It's like me. Same thing. You know, guests will say, "Hey, we know when you're cooking on the station." Yeah. You know, when you're doing the steaks or doing whatever, because of the seasoning and because of the temperatures and everything. You know, comes out the way they want it. Where you know, that's those little details. It's hard to teach somebody in 4 months.
Chef,
you know?
I mean,
you're just trying to teach them how to cook a steak to the right temperature in the beginning, much less, you know, the right amount
When you're a chef these days, and because you cannot hire people with a lot of experience because, you know, the cost of labor, so you have to teach most of the time.
Yeah.
And some of them know, already have some base, but... It's an everyday teacher.
But do they have, the point I was going to make is, do they have an eye for detail? They haven't worked their way up through years of apprenticeship. They haven't experienced a lot of fine dining themselves. They don't, it's quick, that's good enough, that's okay. And what I gather from listening to both of you, certainly Pascal through the years here, has talked about, that's what set his place apart. It wasn't just the passion and the care and the creativity, it was the details, doing it day after day, night after night, getting it out the same way.
Well, it's very important that if you want to have a good employee in your kitchen, the employee has to see that the chef himself cares a lot.
Well, yeah. Everybody respects what you inspect, right?
We met one of your guests on the audio show, and she said, my husband, when he sees something is wrong, I will never serve that. And then
she was talking about her husband owns some restaurants.
Yeah. Let's do it again.
Yeah,
it's very important.
And I don't know that. This is my personal opinion. That's really the standard of most restaurants, especially chains and other things. Good enough, fast enough, seems to be more important.
I think the standard for restaurants are successful.
Yeah.
If you know they don't do that, it won't last.
Yeah. You got to have somebody there who cares. Somebody who's watching and paying attention to little details and stuff. But you can only see so much, too, right? I mean, if steak goes out, looks beautiful, but it has no seasoning on, it hasn't been basted, it hasn't been done right, you know, then it's not going to taste good, right? You know what I mean? Or hasn't been handled properly.
What would be your favorite spices?
You know, I'm very simple. Actually, I'm not a big spice guy. So, I mean, I love, you know, just good salts, different types of salts, sea salts. Specifically, I mean, I think when you're working with great products, you don't need a lot of seasoning. I've never been a big blackening seasoning guy and stuff. So people come to our restaurants and say, "Can we get our salmon blackened and stuff?" It's like, you know, we can try and make a spice up real quick. You know, I know, but it's like we don't really have a blackening spice. We don't really do black. You know, like we got beautiful salmon here. You know, why would you need it blackened? You know, when you can just put. You know, some beautiful
because
sea
most
salt
people
on it.
Don't have beautiful salmon, so they blacken it to cover it, to hide it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think sometimes the inferiority of the product.
Yeah, it's very, not many restaurants use really good salmon. Like, that's why what you guys are doing, what they're doing down there, I think is amazing and awesome, and it's cool. Hopefully, we can, you know, get more of that up here and get rid of that Atlantic salmon that everybody's using.
It's called A0. Steelhead salmon.
A0 steelhead.
Soon in your fish market.
Yeah. Props to them.
Yeah. All right. Anything else you want us to know about the new one? Opens when? So the Met is. I'm trying to picture where that Met part of it. Is it that north of this of the?
That'd be south of south coast,
of,
right?
Yeah, on the other side of
Southeast.
The Bristol.
Yeah,
and it's by. Is that the?
So you have Water Grill, and you got Mastro's.
Avenue
of the Stars. Yeah, so you go right past
Water
Avenue.
Grill, and that's where the Sagerstrom Center is, and all that kind of stuff.
Not far from the Sagerstrom Center.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's the Met. So there's three big tall buildings off the 405 there. Yeah. There's a 24-hour fitness center. It's like the largest 24-hour fitness in the country, I think.
And parking facilities there.
It's going to have a huge event space outside, right? So they're putting in a beer garden. So they just put in Pacific Pearl Michael. He's got a little cafe in there called Pacific Pearl. If you haven't been there, you should go check it out.
When you drive... direction of Newport Beach on the 55. You can see it on the right. You get Bristol, you turn around, you're right there.
Yeah. And then they're working on a beer garden right now.
Beer garden.
Yeah, so they're going to put a beer garden in over there by Pacific Pearl, and then, you know, ours will be next year. But the beer garden, I think, is supposed to be open this year, this fall.
Oh, fun.
So, yeah, so
we
that'll be cool.
More outdoor spaces. I don't know why there aren't more outdoor. There are some.
They're beautiful outdoor spaces.
This is the best, yeah.
Pacific Pearl has a great space there.
Yeah. Because yeah. That's where in Southern California you want to eat outdoors. Mm-hmm. I don't want to eat indoors all the time.
Yeah. Especially if you get out of the theater there, right, and you're in Seagram's Trim, it's like you don't want to go walk into a place where it's all dark and there's no windows.
Or even
again, you
before,
know?
Right. before the
or
show.
Before the show.
Exactly.
It's perfect. And you just walk.
Walk right there.
Yeah.
It's a good spot.
All right.
We're excited. Yeah.
Look forward
They're doing
to
a lot
that.
Of stuff, too. You know, the landlord or the owners of this property are really renovating.
Don't always say we met at the Met.
Yeah.
we met at the Met.
So we'll have to have you guys over. We'll invite you guys when
we're
right open. Yeah.
I'm always trying to
so
tag
is it
along
going
here.
To be called Ocean on Earth?
Yes, it's going to be Oceans on Earth. Yep. Yep. I mean, you got the name. It's like, hey, you know why? You know, people know it now. Like I said, people
are
come
there
from,
more coming? Is this a concept that we'll see growing, or is this?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things where we were talking about earlier.
One at a time.
It's one at a time, and it's a chef driven. Like it's you know, we're gonna have the two spots for a little while going. You know what I mean? So we'll see how that works out. But that's I'm already stretched with that. You know.
Yeah,
I'm not a big chain guy. I mean, it's very rare that when I usually go out to restaurants, I'm going somewhere kind of unique. I think that sounds. I'm sure you do the same thing, Chef, when you go somewhere.
But Chef's talking about all the time these days when people invest in a new restaurant, they're already trying to say the payoff will be the second, the third, the fourth, what one. It's so hard to build one today. It's so expensive that they're immediately the payoff for the investors is perhaps turning it into a concept and a chain.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think that's what he wants.
No, that's a different business model than mine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, mine's more about like it's keep it
personal,
unique, keep it different, you know.
Family oriented and friends.
I love it.
All right. And you're not going to. It's hard to take a farm to table where you're growing the produce right and make that into a chain. You know, it's like
you'd have to have farms everywhere.
Yeah, you have farms everywhere, and it's labor intensive. It really is.
Well, but Seagram has a farm not far from there.
Yeah.
You know, on the 405.
Okay. Right there. Yeah.
I didn't even know they still had farms.
Yeah, that's part of Tanaka.
Beans.
That's there. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
We're gonna be. We're gonna have some garden spaces out there too, both in the front of the restaurant and on the back side. We're gonna put in a farm table as well too, and be able to do dinners out there on a farm. Put a barbecue and a smoker out there and do some fun stuff outside.
Are you gonna have a pit too?
A barbecue pit,
yeah, like Argentinian style, yeah. That's what we're putting out there, a little barbecue.
I can smell it.
Though. Yeah, we have outdoor bars. There's going to be there's ping pong and there's all kinds of.
You're going to have all around. You can have the beer garden, and then you smell the fire pit.
Yeah. Again, an experience.
And that's what, you know, that's why the owners came to us and said, you know, this has really been their kind of vision to make this place into experience, you know.
So I want to talk to about the house. So you can give us your address, and you, not only did you close 2 days a week, huh? Monday?
Oh, yeah, right now we're closed Sunday, Monday.
All right.
Yeah.
And just dinner
right now. 5 o'clock we open. Normally, you know, a lot of times it's reservations only, really, you know, unless you're going to kind of come in and sit at the bar or something, or after 8 o'clock. It's funny because we're in Yorba Linda, so it's like that crowd is between five and eight, right?
Full bar?
We have a full bar, yep.
Now, I would think it's South Coast, though you would want to have brunches and lunches.
Yeah,
and
so we'll be doing lunch and dinner there.
Because you get an office crowd and stuff.
Yeah,
that you can
there's
from.
A bit. There's like 1,200 people or so in that building right there. You know, so there'll be a good lunch business. We'll have to, you know, build up the dinner business a little bit, but because people know, you know, the name already, Oceans on Earth, and you know, we get a lot of people from Newport Beach and Long Beach, and so that'll be the closer point for them to come to.
Love it. You know? All right, thank you.
Exciting stuff.
Is there a website or anything we can go to?
Yeah, go to Oceans on Earth. What is it? onerestaurant.com.
You tell us. I don't know. It's your restaurant.
I'm the worst at these kind of things, too. But you can go to the Met website as well, too. They have some pictures and some...
So wandering.
Yeah, they have drawings, and they're actually doing like a 3D kind of like flyover video of it, so you can see where the beer garden is and Pacific Pearl and us. And
so this is not till this space. Is a year away or 6 months away? What did you say?
Yeah, so March would be our opening. Pacific Pearl's already open, so they already put the cafe in.
Okay.
They're building the beer garden now. I think that's going to be open by, which is House 575.
We should get them in here, too. We should talk about the whole scene here.
Yeah.
There you
go. And you're still doing catering as well.
We're still doing catering. I mean, yeah, like it's 27 years. We've had the same clientele, which
same
is great.
Same name, Oceans and Earth Catering?
Yeah, Oceans and Earth. That name changed over the years, you know, of course, when you first start out, you know, as a caterer, you know, it's Chef Adam, and then it becomes this. And then, but yeah, we still have the same, you know, 4th of July. I mean, here I'm 27 years in a row. Been working 4th of July. Barbecuing for everybody down there in, you know, or Newport Coast, you know.
Newport Coast.
Yeah, but 27 years, you know, it's like, wow.
And you used to work with Patty also.
Yeah, yeah.
And we knew each other for 25 years.
I can gather this. It's like old home week here.
Yeah, one time I came. Remember, I came and we talked about. We even talked about working for him one time. You know,
everybody's working.
And then I went to Napa Valley and then came back. And
we go to events sometimes, and people come up and start, you know, gushing over him. Oh, chef, on this, and I worked. And he looks at me, and says, "Did he work for me? I don't even remember. You can't even remember him all here."
He's got a lot of chefs, like you said, have worked for him.
And thank you for the support with all the charities that you're always part of.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You got it. Our pleasure. Always a good time to get together with the chefs.
You can mean Laguna Beach.
I mean, he's a mentor right here to all of us, you know.
Opened my eyes to lots of things going on out there.
Okay. Yeah. All
right. Oceans and Earth, thanks for coming in.
You got it. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Another journey behind the kitchen doors as we not only look at the best, we hear what's coming. All here on Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beale Applied Innovation Center.